All right, let's head over to the Zoom line. Warren Martin is our guest. Kansas Strong, they're the Kansas Oil and Gas Resource Association. How are you doing today?
Doing good. How about yourself?
Hey, not too bad. It's we're adding video now. We're getting into those worlds and starting
but man,
to do
you,
some different things. Go
but
ahead.
You have a face for radio. I mean, what
I know
videos thing, and I'm teasing with you. You're looking good, man.
No, it is true. I do have a face for radio. That's what kind of, I held back a little bit because I a cancer survivor, so I kind of, you know, went through that whole thing and I lost some weight, so I always have this like sickly look now. But then after I survived cancer, I got alopecia. So every hair on my body was gone. And so when my hair, so I got very self-conscious about that, so I wouldn't, you know, I had weird looking hair patches, all this stuff like that. So I would not go on videos. I wouldn't do any interviews in person, that kind of thing. And then I kind of embraced it a little bit, but then my hair started growing back and it came back like white gray, like, oh geez. Like, see that?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
It's, and, nobody wants to listen to a guy with white hair. So, you know, I kind of, you know, I don't really embrace the video as much as I should, but the thing that I do like, and I've noticed a lot of the fears I had about the stereotypical, you know, I'm actually trained to be in the media. So there's a certain look, there's a certain makeup, there's a certain presentation that does very well. And the older you get, sometimes you veer away from what that ideal presentation is. You still look great, by the way. So that's why they put you on the camera on PBS and in front of other people. But no, I was going to say, but most people, I'm surprised at how open people are to just more about the message than they are about the presentation and look nowadays. From when I kind of grew up, it was more about the presentation than the message. And now it seems, anyways, go ahead.
But and I think that plays right into what, you know, my philosophy with Kansas Strong is, and what I'm trying to do with Kansas Strong and where we're going is the reality that, you know, we live in a world that caters every experience to such a degree. Those experiences are catered to such a degree that when you finally get to a point where you don't trust anyone who caters their experience. And so I think we're in a world right now where, why is TikTok so big? Why is, you know, YouTube videos? Why are social media, most people getting their news from social media? And most of the time, I think the answer comes down to is they want to hear news from people they authentically trust, authentically they rely, even though those people may not be trustworthy. They want to be authentic and they want to hear from real people. And I think that's really the driving message, which is what we've tried to do here at Kansas Strong, is really try and push the envelope to encourage people that are in the industry to be advocates for the industry, because while they may not have that look you're talking about, they might not have those speaking abilities, those skills to be able to present and to share the message the way that some of the rest of us might be able to share the message, they do it more authentically. And there is a huge movement right now for people wanting to hear from authentic speakers that know what they're talking about and are sharing real information that's not politically biased, that's not biased by, you know, social media or special interest groups, but it's just, here's the world I live in, here's what I understand, and I want to put it out there for you to be able to process this information. And that is the message that is really transforming people's lives, I believe.
How much does your message differ? Because any given year, you're going to do 250 to 300 different presentations, from elementary kids to, I think there was a women's bridge club or something you went to or something along those lines. And then you just had PBS last week. So PBS would be really that, more of that formal, if you will. But the bridge clubs and the rotaries, that's a lot informal. But then the schools, boy, you got to really be careful, because a lot of these kids, they might challenge you without even knowing they're challenging you, if that makes sense, because of the way that they are these days. So anyways, well, yeah.
I've never had that. And that's that. I think that is one of the things that one of the hurdles that we're trying to overcome is people are scared to death. I mean, you can take adults that would be more than happy to stand up front of 2,000 other adults and give a presentation and are terrified to go and stand in front of 20 teenagers because mm-hmm. teenagers don't have filters. They're not afraid to say what's on their mind. They're not afraid to put stuff. But in going to all of these schools, I can list on one hand how many times I've been really challenged in an obnoxious way, been challenged by what I was saying in the presentation. And of course, that's a little different. Our school presentation, going back to your original question, our school presentations are pretty standard. They're built around the K-12 principles that are supposed to be taught in schools here in Kansas. We cater it towards that. We don't change it a whole lot. When the data changes, we change our presentation. But other than that, we pretty much, toe the same line. However, my other presentations that we do, when we go into the Freya Club, when we go into men's clubs, when we go into Rotaries and Kiwanis and all of those different events, every single presentation I give is different. Right now, we have a huge campaign going on that's on energy and poverty. And I probably this year have given over 20 presentations on energy and poverty. Not one of them has been the same because the data keeps changing. The data keeps developing. And so every single time, even before we got onto this show, I go in and I look at what are the latest news stories, what has changed, what is oil price, what is gas prices, where are we going? And I develop my talks and change my talks based on what the current climate is. And so, sometimes I go and I have a talk and I talk with people and they say, hey, I want to know your data links. And I was like, okay, well, I'll give you my data links, but my data links are for this date only because those things change as we go on. And in the oil and gas industry, it makes it even more difficult because a lot of our reporting doesn't happen for a year to 2 years, sometimes in some cases, even 3 years after the data is actually brought in. It has to go through all of that refining, has to go through that processing, and then it's reported in these reports. And so when you look at the International Energy's outlook on world energy, a lot of that data that they're relying on is at least 2 years old. And so it you really have to pay attention to the data points that are coming in and make those changes. And so that is what those are two of the things that really scare people off from being energy advocates is one, that they're afraid of standing up in front of people and being chastised, being criticized, being challenged, and data points that they're not going to know. And number two, the data changes on a regular basis. And so you can make a point in a lot of us when the way that we argue, the way that we converse is we generally develop a story. When you think back to how do you tell people about your life, you generally develop a story that is mostly truthful, but we tend to add words here and there that make it a little more lively, make it a little more entertaining. And we hold on to that story for years and years and years and years and years. In the energy industry, you can't do that. It changes. It's constantly changing. It's constantly developing. It's constantly evolving. And so part of my challenge is one, helping people understand that it's okay to say, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but I'll go look it up. I'll get back to you and I'll provide that information. You don't have to have all the answers. It doesn't take a genius to figure out how much oil and gas is involved in every aspect of our life. We can all talk about that. Everybody in the industry can talk about that. That doesn't change. It's changing somewhat, but it's not changing in any significant way, and it's not going to for a long time. And so those are some of the things, is developing those conversations with people to help them understand these are things you can talk about and they're pretty consistent. And these are things that you need to kind of keep an eye on because they change on a regular basis. And then the second aspect of that is then when you get them in front of an audience and they're presenting, helping them understand it's okay to say, I don't know. Here's what I do know. And I don't know that, but I'm okay. And the audience, most audiences, what a lot of people don't understand, because I go into colleges and I teach speech, as a guest lecturer in a lot of colleges. I developed my own speaking style. And so I go into colleges and I teach speech. And one of the things that people don't understand is that most of the time, the vast, vast majority of the time, the audience that is listening to you actually wants you to succeed. They want you to do well. They want you to perform well. They want you to communicate well because they don't want to waste their time any more than you do. They're pulling for you. They're in your corner. And number two, it's okay not to have all the information. The audience wants to know what you know. And they know that you don't know everything. Nobody does. And so they want to understand what is it that you do know, what is it you don't know. And then they're able to go forward and start making decisions moving forward. And I think those are some of the biggest challenges to really getting people in the energy industry to being advocates for the industry is just the fear of, well, you know, how could things go wrong? Just like your question started out, you know, you could contradict me and challenge me without even knowing it. And so from a presenter standpoint, you have to understand that they might not understand that they're challenging me. They might not understand that they're stepping on my toes a little bit. And so that's an educational opportunity. That's opportunity to advance knowledge about our industry.
Mention the hurdles and some of the challenges. And, you know, the energy transition is such a broad term that you can really interpret it however you want.
Mm-hmm.
The dollar going off of, you know, oil currency, basically, you know, some people have made that argument, you know, that the power of the dollar was backed by the oil and gas reserves and who has the military to protect it. And that's where that BRICS came from, with these petroleum backed countries to add some balance. So that's part of the energy transition in some circles, if you will. The other part of the energy transition is energy poverty. And how do we get to energy poverty? Because Kansas has primarily independence. And independence should be doing really well right now. Like right now, because of how regulated kind of or slow moving a lot of the corporations are, independence should be doing great. But they almost seem like they're more shackled than the corporations are. And that's concerning, because I've seen in the media, I've seen in other areas too, but in energy, that's serious business. I mean, energy is, it's not TikTok. It's not tobacco. You know, a lot of people made the comparison of tobacco and oil and gas. Yeah, I could see some of the PR things, but at the end of the day, you're not going to go put cigarettes in your car. You need to put gas in your car. You can't use cigarettes to go fuel your house. So a lot of times we get caught talking about apples and oranges as the same. And so my question is this: how much of the energy transition is PR? And from your perspective, why are the independents not doing better? Because economics says they should.
Yeah. So yeah. I'll answer those two separately. Okay. First one is how much of the energy transition is PR? 100% of it. It's all PR. The idea of a transition, it's where we get into energy, we get into definition of terms, and we don't do enough to actually define what the terms are that we're using. And so I'll give you a classic example. When you talk about oil and gas, when you talk about those numbers that come from oil and gas, you're talking about oil and gas consumption. It's always consumption numbers. When you're talking about renewable energy, you're always talking production numbers.
Yeah.
And then you want to compare the two, and they're not the same. And we produce a lot more than we consume when it comes to energy.
That's a 300 level speech class. That's called persuasive speaking, good sir. Yes. How you choose. I was a speech major. Yes. So when I'm like, oh yeah, I learned about that. And, persuasive speaking. Yes. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's go on.
and so, defining of the terms is very important. And when you understand that when renewable energy is produced, they produce a whole lot more energy than what is actually consumed, because as it goes down the line, it bleeds off, which is why when you drive through drive under a power line, listening to the AM radio, it goes all staticky. Why does it go staticky? Because the energy that's bleeding off of the lines is interfering with your radio because it's losing energy. So the energy that's produced is not the energy that's consumed at the other end. Yet in our world today, we continue to try and compare production numbers on the renewable side with consumption numbers on the fossil fuel side. So that PR goes into the entire mix all the way down, especially when it comes to transition. For most people, the word transition means if I'm going to transition from a Ford to a Chevy, that means I'm going to sell the Ford and I'm going to go get in the Chevy and I'm going to drive the Chevy. I'm giving up one to replace it with the other. And yet that word, that the transition in that way is never used when you're generally talking about energy, even though that's the way most people understand it. When you talk to a layperson on the street and you ask them, what does energy transmission mean? It means we're giving up fossil fuels and we're getting onto renewable sources of energy. And yet that's not happening. Energy is a world market. When you look at the world market, every source of energy across the world continues to rise. Oil, natural gas, hydro, nuclear, yes, wind and solar, biofuels, all increasing. Coal, which most people in America think is dead, coal is continuing to increase in the world. So every form of energy is continuing to increase in the world, and therefore no transition is actually taking place. What is taking place is the energy market is growing. The energy demands and the energy needs continue to grow as we go forward. And yes, renewables are taking a market share of that new growing market, but they're not actually replacing anything. Beyond a local or a regional scope, they're not replacing anything. So while they may have replaced coal here in the United States with natural gas, that's not a energy wide or worldwide feature that is taking place because China is greatly amplifying their coal because we're not using it anymore. So coal has plummeted. So now they can use it even cheaper. And so they continue to grow. And so I think it's really important when we start talking about these terms, I refuse to use the word energy transition because I maintain there is no energy transition taking place. What we should be talking about is our energy future. And our energy future takes into account where are we at now, and what are the steps moving forward? And I think everybody in the world wants to be more environmentally conscious, but we don't want to disrupt the entire GDP. We don't want to disrupt the entire lifestyle of all of Americans everywhere. We don't want to push more people into poverty. So we need to take an account of where we currently at in our energy and utilize that information, utilize new technologies, utilize new ways to utilize oil and gas, utilize coal, utilize all forms of energy to the most environmentally friendly way possible going forward. And that's what we should be talking about, our energy future. What does that future look like? Because nobody right now that's serious in energy is proposing that we completely do away with fossil fuels and go to completely renewable sources of energy. Anybody who says that is somebody who's completely disconnected from the energy sector. Because there's just absolutely no way that that is conceivably possible at this point.
That's a very astute observation because that's high level. This is 400 or 500 level persuasive speaking. So when you say energy transition, even if you don't say it and you hear it and you read it, you are 100% correct. Your mind defines transition.
Yes.
Whether you even know it or not, whether you know it. So your mind has already made the decision for you that we are transitioning off of fossil fuels onto renewables because I hear it every day. They teach it at school. And now the media is saying it. And now the governors are saying it. Now the oil executives are using that word. So when people in the industry, Doug Burgum, North Dakota governor, he was all about the energy transition. And so when I'm thinking about it going, I never thought of it from that perspective, which is as soon as you say the word energy transition or hear it, your mind is made up. We are going away from our traditional energy sources and bringing in something new. Yeah. So they're arguing without even knowing they're arguing.
Yeah,
that's incredible manipulation.
Yeah, I would say that in many times, anytime you use the term energy transition, you've conceded the argument before you've even had it.
Yes.
And that's a dangerous place, especially when our own industry starts using those terms. I went to a major trade show function and we were trying to come up with 5 talking points on energy transition. And I just told the group in the room, I said, look, if I go back to Kansas and I start promoting, here are 5 points on energy transition, they're going to fire me tomorrow. Because that's not who we are. That's not who we are in Kansas. That's not who we are as an industry. And there's no data that shows that that is happening, is occurring, or that there's a plan to even make it possible to transition.
That is some very good
talking about that energy future.
No, but that's important to point out. And I'm sorry for interrupting,
but you're fine.
I wanted to point out that is a great example of how things change without anybody knowing it, because a lot of people get paid to go to meetings. That's their jobs. They go to meetings.
Yep.
And they do. They got to come up with something that somebody told them to do. Okay, well, let's come up with 5 talking points. So what you're asking, and thank goodness you stood your ground, what that meeting was saying, we need to come up with 5 points to change our mission statement. We need to come up with 5 points to convince the board of directors. We need to go a whole new direction with what we've been talking about the last 10, 15, 20 years. Yeah. That's what I interpret that as.
Yeah. Yeah.
But because, and I do that a lot in the media, you know, like you know, the difference between a promotion and a legit news story. And yeah. So a lot of times but to me, this is very similar to where, trying to change your marketing and your mission statement at that level, a lot of people wouldn't fight it. It would fly under the radar. And by the time they realize what happened, it's too late type of a thing. So do you think that's because of the amount of independence you have, that these independents, it's their company? It's like, it's not a job. You know what I mean? Like so many people don't give 2 craps about what happens as long as they get their paycheck.
Paycheck, yeah.
Companies are a different story.
Oh, yeah. And companies are a very different story. And here in Kansas, you know, we have the average oil company in Kansas has 3 employees.
Yeah.
The vast majority, 90%+ of our oil companies here in Kansas, they do not have an HR department or PR department because they only have 3 employees. And so they have no one there that's going to advocate for them, that's going to put out press releases, that's going to do those types of things. And so on the one side, it really kind of funnels more of that messaging to an organization like ours, Kansas Strong, which represents those independent oil and gas producers here in the state. It allows us to speak more on their behalf. And on the other side of it, you have to realize that the people we're talking about, they're not there to get a paycheck. They're not there to pick up a Friday paycheck at the end of every week. It's their job. It's their life. They got their entire life savings. They got everything wrapped up in this company. And so it's not something they take lightly or something that they walk away from lightly. And so that's what I think that makes us very different as an oil producing state from a lot of other states that are out there, because we don't have a lot of people that are just on the payroll.
Well, and that's interesting, because if your position would be, hey guys, here's 5 reasons you should shut your company down.
Yeah.
Because if we're energy transitioning, you know, but let's get back to the actual true definition of what we're talking about, because it's energy future is a great way to do it. I wrote down energy, you know, sifting and shaping, if you will, because there's a little bit of a shift happening with how it's sorting out a little bit. And we saw this in the media. Newspaper had a monopoly for a long time. Now they actually don't make up a very big chunk of it. They had to reinvent themselves into more of a content company, because newspapers still produce most of your original news. Social media is a reaction to that original news. So when you take a look at, when I talk to people and they start giving me the, we have to get rid of oil, you know, they started giving me those polarizing statements. I'll just say something like, do you want safety packages on your needles and on your Lunchables? And, you know, do you want some safety sanitary things in this world? And they say yes, and say, okay, well, I'm sure they'll find a place for it, because all energy has a purpose. We just got to figure out what it's for. coal, I think, will probably save our drinking water problem one day more than anything, and that kind of thing, because we are getting smarter about our energy. Our energy consumption is going up, but I think that's more going up from a factory and Bitcoin side of things, where your technology is taking a lot more energy than humans are.
Yeah.
And so that's part of this too. But anyway, sorry, I said a lot there, but go on with your.
No, you brought up two really good points. And one of them that I want to come back to a little bit later on, but the one I want to hit on right now is what you talked about, energy sifting or shaping. And I would agree that there's a lot of energy experimentation that's taking place right now, mm-hmm. and a lot of regional shifting that's taking place right now. But again, anytime you mention the word transition, for all you have to do is look at in order for something to transition, something goes up, something comes down, something improves, something decreases. And that is not happening anywhere. So what actually is happening? And I think it comes back to another marketing term, and that marketing term that is used in every news story about energy right now is the term market share. And market share in most people's minds is that you have, if you have $100 and you're valued at market share of 50% of that, and I've got the market share of 50% of it, then both of us have 50 cents. And we both understand that. So most people, that's their simple understanding of market share. So when they start talking about, okay, electric vehicles are right now in the single digits, are expected to grow to 13% of the market share by 2035. Well, that sounds like they're taking over. We're transitioning. There's a transition mm-hmm. taking place because they're going up. But that's not what's happening. That's not what's happening at all. So I'll give you a quick example. Let's take you got a family or you got a neighborhood that's got 10 houses in it. Each one of those houses has an internal combustion engine car. And so 100% of this market, the market share of this neighborhood is internal combustion engine cars. But you have the Smith family that decides they want to trade in theirs to get an electric vehicle. Now, 10% of that neighborhood is electric vehicles. However, the Gonzalez is down the road. They have a daughter that's going to go to school. And so she's finishing up her senior year. So they go buy her a cheap internal combustion engine car, bring it into the neighborhood. And you got the Alvarez's that live down the street on the other end. They picked up a second job so that they can meet their bills. So they pick up a second vehicle that's also an internal combustion engine car, and they bring it into the neighborhood. So in this neighborhood that before we had 10 cars, now we have 12 cars. One of them is electric. According to market share, the market share in that neighborhood has transitioned to 8% electric vehicles. But
yes.
The reality is there's one more internal combustion engine car in that neighborhood than there was before we began. It didn't diminish internal combustion engines at all. All it did was the market grew. Renewables took a share. That's what's happening all over the world. Is the market is expanding, renewables are taking a share, but they're not taking as much share as the market is expanding. Therefore, all other energy sources continue to expand as well. But in all of the media, anytime that they talk about renewables, what they're going to hammer in on is market share and the fact that market share has increased by this amount. And in most consumers' mind, we have this limited idea that market share is a fixed quantity. And so if you increase the market share, that means that there's less of this and more of that. But when you understand it's an expanding market, you can increase the market share. And if the market increase does not surpass the increase of the market share of the market as a whole, then you haven't gained any ground. You just kept oil and natural gas or fossil fuels from expanding even further.
Where is the oil and gas leadership on this?
And that's the challenge right now. I think in America, and I'm going out on a limb here, maybe looking for a job from you next week after I say this. I'll go out on a limb and say it. There's really a division within the oil and gas industry as a whole right now. And that division is between the majors and or what we call a lot of times big oil and the independents. And so you got 20% of the oil and gas producers, the majors that are here in the United States that produce 80% of the oil. And then you've got 80% of the producers, which are the small independents, mostly small independents and small corporations. that only produce 20% of the oil here in the United States. And what we're seeing is going through all of this over the past few decades, is a lot of the major oil companies have found that, and rightly so in their regard, I don't fault them at all for this because it's business. You've got to find a way to move forward as a business. But a lot of them have found that working with the federal government and developing biofuel programs, developing carbon capture programs, developing all of these programs and caveats, it keeps the pressure off of them so that they can continue doing business. And so they've really developed that relationship of working with the government in a variety of different ways. On the other hand, you have the independents, which the government doesn't want to work with because they're too small. They don't have the capital. They don't have the resources. They don't have R&D departments. And so the government tends not to work with them. And so what I think we're really seeing here in the United States is when it comes to oil leadership is you got two different versions of it. You have the independent oil leadership and you have the major oil leadership, and they're really kind of pivoting against each other. And I think the government is really using that at this point in time, because the government would like for nothing more than to put the 80% of producers that only produce 20% of the oil, those independents, out of business, so that it can just work with the 20% of producers that have already willing to play ball and allow them to take over more of the market share, give them greater opportunity to control the price of oil and gas, to influence the price of oil and gas, and also to implement regulations that independents generally are the ones who bristle against.
Yeah, again, that's the difference between family business and employees of, you know, corporations.
Yeah.
They'll always justify the shareholders, but that's not the same as a family business. I mean, look at all the politicians that own shares, these companies that they turn around and try to regulate. So to me, it's interesting because when you take a look at how abusive relationships work, a lot of times somebody with a narcissistic tendency will surround themselves with people that are easily controlled with by money, not values.
Right.
And so a lot of family businesses really have a lot of family values, a lot of traditional, you know, Christian based or Hindu based or Muslim based. There's basically a very similar plot in most of your mainstream religions and even the golden rule to a certain degree. But when you start leading people with money and platitudes, you know, idealistic things that are feelings over facts, if you will, that to me seems like it was almost done by design, because most of the people that were, you know, the Chevron doctrine, for example, a lot of those people were considered experts. So that's who the government took advice from. And so when you take a look at those 20% that produce 80% and the 80% that produce the 20, the 80% that if they go away, that's going to cost the government a lot more money than if they would have just gave them a helping hand or a level playing field, just a level playing field.
And
that's really a lot of the independents I've talked to. That's all they want. Playing field. You know, well, go ahead.
And they want the level playing field because, you know, then it becomes a free market system. And, you know, we live in a democratic republic, but we tend to forget that it's a democratic republic, and we tend to always talk about democracy. And really, the only true place that you have a true democracy is in a free market where people choose to spend their money. And so you level that playing field, and that gives the consumer the ability to decide what they want to do with their energy future, how they want to spend that energy future. But I definitely agree with you that a lot of this is by design, because they know beyond a shadow of a doubt that if they are able to put those 20% of producers, the 80% of producers out of business that produce 20% of the oil, it's going to artificially raise oil and gas prices around the world, especially here in America. But it's going to artificially raise those prices. When it does that, then it frees up the government to where they can pull back more of the more of the funding that they're giving to renewable sources of energy and provide that, quote, level playing field. Because if you've artificially inflate the oil and gas prices, now renewables look more economically viable. And so I don't think any of it's by accident. I think all of it is by design. I think the way the terminology and the way that we talk about energy is by design. And I think that's why it's key for people in our industry to be very clear about the terms that we are utilizing when we talk about oil and gas energy. And we talk about the future of energy, we need to be very clear about the terms that we're using and not just go with what everybody's talking about in the industry. Because if I throw out the word transition, if I throw out the word renewable, if I throw out the word viable, if I throw out the word sustainable, all of those words, everyone knows what they believe it means. But I guarantee you, if you have a room full of 100 people, you're going to have 100 different definitions on what those words actually mean, because they mean something different to every single person based on what they've learned about energy in the back. And so it's important that we in the energy industry understand that miscommunication that's taking place so that we can more effectively communicate in a way that people understand exactly what we're saying.
How are the independents responding to the new trinity of control with the carbon energy ag sector that's happening? I mean, you're in Kansas, so I'm not sure how connected the three industries are at this point. In North Dakota, where they have the primacy, they were able to advance some of the things, and seeing the same template in Wyoming, seeing the same template in Louisiana. You start with the university works with its corporate partners, they then take over the carbon and oil market. And ag too, to a certain degree, if you want to include the next phase, if you will, that's going to be introduced through carbon management and agriculture. But when I take a look at what I've had three guests say now, three guests on this program that work in the carbon market, all of them say that the government is driving the whole industry, meaning that there's no free market for the carbon market. When you take a look at the fact that in the last 4 years, there's been more money printed than the first 250 years America was a country. They literally created a whole new country in the last 4 years. And now the government controls all of that marketplace with carbon, energy, and ag. I don't even want to get into the money part of things, because those are probably the people behind the government. I don't know. It's the money. But I was just trying to think. I don't know what's left to control when you control somebody's energy, their ag, and their carbon output. But to me, that's a little bit concerning to Kansas, because you have all those independents. I think Tallgrass is out of Kansas. Mm-hmm. They're working on a carbon project, I believe, in Kansas. And a lot of the independents, I mean, I'm not sure if they're going to get a seat at the table when it comes to this carbon industry, which is controlled apparently by three people in the industry, 100% by the government. So talk to me a little bit about what's going on with your carbon industry, how the independents are. Is there anything going on there? I mean, yeah, to me, I'm concerned.
We have several strata that are ideal for carbon capture. And so a lot of that is taking place here. Like you say, it is being led a lot by the universities here.
It is there too.
Yeah, and started okay. Started and led by university programs or university affiliate programs, mm-hmm. that are funded by the federal government. And when you talk to them, you know, I've got into several very deep conversations with many of them. And when you talk to them, you know, what they finally end up saying is, well, this money's going to be spent somewhere, so why not in Kansas? Otherwise, it's going to go to another state. And that's kind of the hook and sinker. You know, that goes back to, and it's nothing new in America. It goes back to the person that's responsible for that is Alexander Hamilton. And he's the one who started the modern day financial background that we have in America. A lot of people want to think this is a new thing. It's not a new thing. Alexander Hamilton was under George Washington, was put in a position where he had to figure out on the financial side of things. How do we keep 13 independent states together as a single nation? And Alexander Hamilton came up with the idea. The way we do that is we pay off their debt. We go in and we pay off the debt of all 13 nations or all 13 states, so that all 13 states are then incumbent to be a part of this nation, because if they separate from us, then they're responsible for their own debt again, which they can't pay. And that's been the modus operandi of the federal government since the Revolutionary War, that the government will pay you to do this, and you can't do it without the government's money, therefore you have to do it. And that's kind of the operation process they've taken. When it comes to carbon capture, that's kind of the same thing. It's you know, they put the carrot out there to get you to buy into it being controlled by the federal government. In some cases, it's good. We have quite a few ethanol plants that are around here, and ethanol plants are struggling with the federal government to take care of their carbon. And so we're able to capture that carbon from those CO2 plants, from the CO2 from those ethane plants, and be able to capture that. And so we got independent producers that are involved in that, that have their fields that are being used as carbon capture facilities. We have our seismic companies that are helping to identify these caverns that we can put the CO2 in, the strata that we can put the CO2 in. And that's a big boon for the seismic companies, because once you use it as carbon capture, it has to be shot every 2 years to make sure that it's maintaining its integrity and that you're not losing the CO2. So, I mean, there's upsides and downsides to everything. But again, you're not talking about a free market solution that has taken place. You're talking about a program that is built on reducing our environmental impact. That's being funded by the federal government, which means being funded by the taxpayer, which overall is increasing the cost of energy across the board.
My uncle would say that we are working to fund the rope that is going to hang us. That's what my uncle would say, that we are working in order to pay taxes to fund the rope, or pay for the rope that's going to end up hanging us in the end. Yeah. That's what that story reminded me of. My uncle just said, yeah, that's what's happening here. In a lot of cases, people do feel like that. Part of the thing that's happening is with the carbon, there are new markets opening. You mentioned the seismic market. There had been a small seismic market before, but this carbon industry should open up that market incredibly too. A very data driven industry as well. What can you expand on that? Every 2 years, you got to shock the system a little bit on that, because I had never heard that before.
Yeah. So basically, to identify a strata that you can put CO2 in, the process for that's pretty extensive. You send out a seismic team that goes out, they take out their thumper trucks. They thump the ground, they build a underground 3D map of the field in which you're going to capture the CO2. Make sure that there's no fault lines, make sure that there's no ruptures anywhere, that it's securely enclosed with an impermeable layer above it, an impermeable layer below it, where that carbon's going to stay where we put it. And so that's in a very extensive process at the beginning. Mm-hmm. But then, because it's not unlike oil and gas, you shoot a field, you might not shoot that field again for 20 years or until the technology changes, because you can always go back and look at what you shot the last time and get a pretty good idea of where you want to drill, where you don't want to drill. But when it comes to CO2 capture, the goal is not to get something out. The goal is to keep stuff in, to keep it in that formation. And so what that requires is then they have to come back every 2 years, reshoot it to make sure there's no faults that have opened up. There hadn't been any land shifts, because the earth is constantly moving. And so they constantly, every 2 years, have to go back and reshoot it to make sure that you still have a solid place that you can store the carbon where it's going to stay where you put it. And so that has been a boom for the seismic market.
Yeah, and I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but I've been doing some of these carbon interviews up here in North Dakota, and one of the radio stations I'm on, we do a weekly carbon update, and Lori Hinz from Beck News, she's been following this for a couple of years, doing weekly reports on this carbon pipeline, and she attends a lot of the public meetings. And she's brought up the seismic thing about how they were kind of reacting and asking for the seismic stuff. And I said, well, yeah, because somebody realized it's monetizable. And they didn't realize that for a while because it's new to this area. And so so it's kind of reactionary on some places too. And that's kind of the problem with the free market, because the people in control, once they realize, oh, I guess that seismic stuff is monetizable, well, we better do that now too. So they kind of block everybody from doing that. And we've seen that more and more over the past decade in many, many of the fields. What's the takeaway for a lot of this? Because there is a little bit of a shift happening where a lot of the independents are getting, I say they're getting pushed in the cracks. They're not falling in the cracks. They're getting pushed in the cracks. And some people are getting defeated out there, but you're out there fighting the good fight. You're doing the outreach, talking about energy poverty. The more independence we have, the cheaper energy is going to be. I believe that. And I think the history will back me up on that.
And the closer we're going to be to a fair market.
Exactly. And you take out the government waste, and you take out another issue we had is where a couple oil companies gave $1 million to a nonprofit that killed $1 million worth of trees. So then they turned around and gave them an award to cover it up. So you killed $1 million worth of trees. You spent all that energy covering it up, basically 2 years of covering up a bunch of crap that someone else could have done if it was the free market.
Yeah.
But because of who they are and what they are, they got it. And it was just like, you know, so what's your takeaway from this? I mean, we've kind of been all over the board a little bit, but you know what do you want people to take away from what we've been talking about?
I think a takeaway is exactly what originally we started out talking about that we never really even got to because we got onto so many other things. But I said we'd get to it, and that was that PBS interview, and so we were doing a PBS interview in their our local PBS station in Wichita, Kansas. They have a discovery center that's a kids' hands-on STEAM, science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. It's a STEAM facility. And so in that, we actually implemented and built a kiosk that's in there. There's actually two of them that are side-by-side, where one of them you go through and you actually go through a simulated drilling process where you drill down 6,000 feet, do a horizontal drill, detonate, and you see all of the process. You see where we put the pipe in to protect groundwater. You see all of the stuff that we do throughout the entire process. The other one is our seismic station, where you go and you pick somewhere in Kansas you want to look for oil, and then it counts you down and you jump on a pad, and that sends the seismic vibrations down into the ground and tells you if there's oil present at that location or not. And very simple things that are, you know, designed for kids to kind of get an idea of some of the things that we do. But I think that that's where it begins. It begins with education. And that's why I've keyed in so much on the terminology that we use, on the stories that we tell, on the how we present stuff, and really hammering down, not just picking up where the media is leaving off, but actually creating our own story. And I think that is the real challenge for our industry, is we live in a world where the media wants to build the frame around which you have to have the conversation. And then you can only have the conversation within that frame. And mm-hmm. the frame itself eliminates the ability for any oppositional views. And so we as an industry have to stop looking at what the media is saying and really look at the data and start with the data and say, okay, what is really happening in the world? And starting from ground zero, how do we share that? Starting from ground zero, how do we share that in a way that is compelling, that people can understand, and that they can, you know, grasp a hold of to help them make decisions to shape their energy future. And that's not an easy job, but we're in a big ship, and you don't turn a big ship on a dime. It takes a lot of acreage to turn a big ship out at sea. And so I think that that's where we're at with the industry right now. There's no quick fix to it. There's nothing that's going to turn this ship around tomorrow. But I think that challenging our own people, the people, every single person from the pumper and the rig hand and guy throwing chain on the rig floor, all the way up to the CEOs of our major companies, all of us have to become energy advocates. That's the only way we get the ship turned around.
You got a website people can go to?
Absolutely. Go to kansasstrong.com. Right now, we got videos up about our energy and poverty campaign that we're running. And you can find out a lot of other information about some of our past campaigns. And there's a great series on there about life without oil and natural gas is life without X. We got one I know that you would like. Life without oil and natural gas is life without beer. And we talk about how oil and gas is essential to so many of the things that we depend upon every single day. It's a whole series of videos up there, from food trucks to asphalt to beer to glass blowing across the board. So we got a lot of great videos that are there, but you can find all of that at kansasstrong.com. All of my contact information is on there as well, so people can connect with me if they have questions or if they have something they want me to talk about. I'd be happy to entertain any type of inquiries that they'd like to send to me, all at kansasstrong.com.
And how about the PBS interview? Is that, do you have links there, or should people go to the PBS site for that?
I don't have them yet. We did the interview. It was recorded. And so I'm waiting for the links and stuff for that. As soon as I have those, I'll be pushing those out.